It's a pleasure for me to interview Dr. Frank. If I go into the credentials of Dr. Frank, the podcast will be over by the time I'm done with it. But suffice to say that Dr. Frank is he's a chair in hematology here at Emory and Winship Cancer Institute. In the past, he has had a very long and very accredited history in the field of hematology and leukemia specifically. And it is a pleasure and a privilege to talk to Dr. Frank. So thank you, Dr. Frank, for taking the time to talk with us today.
It's my pleasure to be with you.
So we were going to talk about your past experience and how, you know, kind of your journey in your all the way to being a stalwart in the field. I had the pleasure of looking over your past journey. And we'll talk about different aspects of this, but I wanted to start with, I know you were at MIT at one point, Yale, Harvard, Emory, and we'll talk about all of that. But I wanted to start by kind of talking about this beginnings. Where did you grow up and what was that like?
Well, I was born and raised in Brooklyn, New York, and education was very important in my family. I went to the New York City public schools. I went to Stuyvesant High School in New York, and I had an early interest both in science and in medicine. I had a particular interest in trying to help people, and that's what I wanted to devote my career to. So that was kind of how I started on this path.
Your parents, were they in the medical field? What was growing up in New York like?
Well, neither of my parents were in medicine. They both were educated and they valued education. And there were a lot of discussions about current topics and science and math. My mother, in fact, was a math major in college. Oh, wow. So okay. There was just a lot of scientific discussion in the family. And I wanted to devote myself to trying to help people. And at an early age, that really became very appealing to me, even though I didn't have any direct role models in that field.
Dr. Frank, you after finishing your schooling, I saw that you went for your undergrad to MIT.
So again, I went to Stuyvesant High School, a science-directed high school in New York. And I wanted to continue an education, pursuing scientific knowledge and pursuing scientific research. And when I had the opportunity to go to MIT, it seemed like a perfect way to pursue that. I loved my time at MIT. I was a biology major. And one of the unique aspects of an MIT education was the encouragement of doing research while an undergraduate. So I did work in a cancer immunology laboratory, and I just loved that experience. Not only the classroom learning about biology and biological sciences, but actually performing research in a cutting-edge laboratory.
Great, great. So you obviously will be talking about the magnanimous career that you've had in hematology since that time. But then at what point did you know that you wanted to go into medicine?
Well, there were a number of formative experiences I had, one of which actually was my grandfather died suddenly. He had a cardiac arrest. I was with him. And this was quite a few years ago where there were not defibrillators available and things of that nature. And I was relatively young at the time. An ambulance was called, but he died at that time. And I felt terrible, of course, losing my grandfather, but I also felt that I never wanted to be in a position where somebody needed medical help and I could do nothing but only stand by. And that was one of the big catalysts for me to say, I want to get a medical education. I want to be able to help people. I never want to stand by when somebody needs medical care. And I think at that moment, that was when I knew that I was definitely going to pursue a career in medicine.
How old were you in your time?
So I was about 13 at the time. So I was old enough to know what was going on, but I certainly was not old enough to do anything meaningful. It was in a public space. My grandmother was there. It was a very terrible experience. Yeah. But I kind of used that in a positive way to say, okay, I'm going to try to help people in the future.
That's amazing to have that clarity. And so when you were in MIT, you already knew what your North Star was. You knew what you were planning to do after MIT. And then, you know, you went on to Yale and do your residency and MD and such. What was that New York to Massachusetts to Connecticut kind of a, and it's still not very far, but I'm sure they had their own distinct characters, the cities did. How was that?
Well, so I grew up in New York. I went to high school on the subways every day. So at a young age, I was kind of deep into the New York experience. And again, MIT was sort of this new place to go to, and going to Boston was very exciting. Of course, in Boston, there are many universities, there are many students, there's a culture of education and youth and entrepreneurship. So I took to that right away. I really loved MIT and I loved the whole Boston-Cambridge experience. And then it was a combination of my desire to be a physician and my research experience that drove me to look at combined MD-PhD programs. So that, again, once I understood what a combined medical scientist training program was, I thought, this is exactly the path for me. And those were the programs to which I applied. And this opportunity to do an MD and PhD at Yale seemed like a wonderful path to take. And that was the next thing I pursued.
Of course. So MIT being engineering and then PhD, like, you know, medicine, how was that a help? Or because, you know, the engineering part, I'm thinking, would have been a very math kind of focus. How did the pivoting go?
So I took away a lot of great things from MIT. One of them was the combination of a focus on understanding basic mechanisms, as well as having practical solutions for real-world problems. So really, both of those were inherent in the culture at MIT. And although I did not pursue engineering or physics or one of the so-called hard sciences, that combination of really trying to do groundbreaking research, but having practical applications to human beings, that combination I definitely took away from MIT and brought to my medical career.
Great. I saw, Dr. Frank, that, you know, when you went to Yale, you did your MD, your residency, you were a chief resident at that time as well. And during your residency, when you started, were you sure you wanted to then pursue? How did the hematology oncology come? Obviously, we said that you wanted to help and your research that stands for itself. But how did you migrate towards oncology and hematology?
Well, interestingly, I was attracted to oncology again at an early stage in my education. And it came from dual pathways. One, I wanted to help people, and I wanted to help people who had serious medical problems. So that was important to me. And clearly, especially a few decades ago, cancer was something that people didn't even want to talk about. And I recognized that this was a place where I can apply myself to help people who really needed medical help. At the same time, it was clear that we needed new treatments for cancer. At that time, the only treatments were cytotoxic drugs. They had widespread side effects. And I felt if we can understand the basic mechanisms of cancer and cancer pathogenesis, perhaps we could devise new rational targeted therapies that would treat the cancer and not harm the rest of the patient. And so it's a dual approach, taking care of people with serious illnesses, a large unmet need for research and bringing them together. That's what attracted me to oncology.
Great. And obviously, you continued that, your PhD, and then you were at Harvard, and then you stayed there in multiple leadership roles and, you know, great career there and then since as well. In your whole time during your fellowship at Harvard, and then you have obviously this 30,000 feet view, you have seen the whole field kind of wall. How would you say the field has kind of evolved, you know, before your eyes, because you have a very unique vantage point in talking about the evolution of hematology over your career. So how would you say that the treatments, have they changed? And what do you say about that?
So what attracted me to do my fellowship at the Dana-Farber Cancer Institute was the focus not only on excellence in patient care, but doing research to develop new treatments. And that's what I wanted to do. So when I started fellowship, when I started on the faculty at Dana-Farber and Harvard Medical School, the only treatments we had were these cytotoxic drugs that had been identified in the 1940s and 50s, drugs like alkylating agents and antifolates and things of that nature. But one of my colleagues at Dana-Farber was Brian Drucker, who was a fellow a few years ahead of me, and he was studying chronic myeloid leukemia. And people understood at that time that there was a fusion oncoprotein, BCR-ABL, that was driving the pathogenesis. And Brian really wanted to ask the question, could we identify drugs to block the kinase activity of BCR-ABL, and would that be effective in treating chronic myeloid leukemia? Now, looking back, people say, well, of course, that's obvious. But at the time, there were many, many naysayers. Well, chronic myeloid leukemia, it's not that common of a disease. You know, pharmaceutical companies won't be that interested in it. There were a lot of people who discouraged him, but I think Brian exemplified that he was scientifically very astute, but he was also driven to help patients. And this was not just an interesting science problem. This was a question of treating a disease that whose natural evolution then was towards becoming to an accelerated phase and a blast phase. It was difficult to treat, and short of a bone marrow transplant, it was usually lethal. So it was in that environment, starting with, you know, the Dana-Farber Cancer Institute was founded by Sidney Farber, whose big drug were antifolates, the precursors to methotrexate. And then not too far ahead of me was Brian Drucker developing what we now call Gleevec, or imatinib, that was the first targeted drug based on a rational understanding of the pathogenesis of a disease and targeting that. And that was a real revolution therapeutically.
Great. So like Brian Drucker, like, you know, you have significant contributions in the transcription, the STAT pathways and such. Over your career, would if you had to think about a few people who have kind of impressed you, and maybe not mentor, but like somebody who on your way up, you kind of looked up to, you say?
Yes. And again, I was fortunate to have teachers, professors, mentors who both taught me and inspired me. So, you know, my undergraduate research mentor, Herman Eisen, a well-known immunologist at MIT. So just hearing how he approached science, how he looked at important problems and addressing them. My PhD advisor, Alan Sartorelli, again, very dedicated to developing new treatments for cancer. And then at Dana-Farber's, when I really began to see physician scientists, people who exemplified phenomenal care for patients, and this idea of let's think about new ways we can treat people. And I had many colleagues and mentors from leukemia experts like Bob Mayer and Richard Stone, to physician scientists like Bill Kalin, who went on to win the Nobel Prize for his work on oxygen sensing, people who are rigorous scientists who wanted to do really important research, but also understood the patient is always the prime focus on what we do.
One thing about that time, Frank, that, you know, you have had, like you mentioned, great mentors, and they kind of took you, you know, you were impressed by the way they were approaching things. And we could talk at length about your career and the stellar career you've had there and since. Do you recall any time when you kind of had a setback or something that, you know, when you were kind of at Yale or at Brigham, or that things you worked towards it didn't go, and then how did you approach that?
Well, I think that's a very important point. And now that I mentor students and trainees, we talk about this a lot. So obviously in science, experiments frequently do not work. Grant applications are not funded. Manuscripts submitted to journals are rejected. I mean, that is the nature of biomedical research. And the word resiliency is talked about a lot, but it can be difficult when you have a great idea and you get that letter saying, I'm sorry that we received many meritorious applications and yours was not selected. But having faith in what we're doing and why we're doing things, again, to help patients, to help people who are dealing with difficult illnesses, I think that has always regenerated my interest, no matter how discouraging situations were, focusing on trying to help people, which is really how I started my medical career, even when I was a teenager, thinking I want to help people. That always continues to recharge me and recenter my thoughts and allow me to keep pushing forward.
Great. So then, as we say that, you know, you went on to Harvard and then, you know, you were there for a very long time. If you had to look at your career at Harvard, which is any particular moments that come to mind that were like, you know, really highlights, your whole career is a highlight, but even within that, any certain particular moments that come to mind that you were, how are you really proud of? And
well, I would say, you know, one of the things I enjoy greatly all the time is taking care of patients and being in an exam room with a patient or being in a hospital room with a patient, no matter what else is going on with one's life, the focus on that one individual in front of you, that I've never lost the desire to really help that person who we're taking care of. Obviously, being a physician scientist, running a laboratory, having drugs identified in our lab go into clinical trials to block abnormal transcriptional pathways, both in blood cancers and other types of cancer, that is very encouraging. That is very enjoyable. And then, of course, having students, having trainees, and seeing them be successful, that, I think, is one of the most enjoyable parts of being in academics. So if you really think about how can we have the longest lasting impact in our careers, yes, it's wonderful making discoveries and seeing those go to help patients, but having that next generation of doctors and scientists and trainees go on to make their own contributions, that has been probably the most rewarding part of my career.
I can attest firsthand that it kind of shines through your commitment to, you know, helping others in their careers. So I can kind of attest to that. One other thing, Frank, that when you were at Harvard and then afterwards you came to Atlanta, what was that transition like?
Well, so I was very happy at Dana-Farber. I thought I would end my career there. And then I had this opportunity to become the director of hematology at Emory. And I had no connection to Atlanta or Emory, but I was invited to come and look at the program. So there were many things that appealed to me. One is that Atlanta, the metropolitan Atlanta area, is about the size of the metropolitan Boston area. But in Atlanta, Emory was the only large academic medical school, whereas in Boston, there are multiple medical schools and multiple hospitals for each medical school. And I thought that here is a place that was growing, that was booming, that had a young faculty, and perhaps I could come and take the lessons I had learned in my years at Dana-Farber and at Harvard and try to bring that to Emory and to Atlanta. And that is what inspired me, somewhat to my own surprise, to pack up and move 900 miles to Atlanta, where I am now.
Absolutely. So, you know, I'm looking at like Stuyvesant, MIT, Yale, Harvard, like, you know, really Ivy League places, and Emory, of course, in a sense. If you had somebody who's now, you know, who's now aspiring to kind of follow your footsteps in their career, or like, you know, if you had to talk to your 18-year-old self, if you could, what would your advice be?
Well, it may sound cliche, but following your passion is so important that you have to follow your heart. And a lot of smart and talented people have teachers and mentors that they want to please. And sometimes they're following a path to please somebody else. And it really is important to do what you think will have the highest impact for your own satisfaction. So I considered alternate career paths. I considered alternate specialties and so on. But I kept trying to come back to what did I really want to do? Where did I want to make my contributions? And so I encourage students and trainees to think about that too, that not only getting the A+ from your teacher and making other people happy, but where will you be happy in a career where you feel that you're giving back to society in the broadest way? That was important to me. I really try to encourage that in my own students and trainees.
So that's so quintessential at careers to kind of, from a mentor especially, I'm sure your trainees and mentors, mentees are so lucky to have you as their mentor, is to try and get the advice that you don't do it to please you. That's very impressive. Over this career, Frank, if you had to, like, what is the best compliment? I mean, I'm sure you've had tons of it, but like, if you had to think of one, like, you know, that kind of really stuck with you, what is the best compliment you have received so far?
Well, I would say that there are two kinds of things that are meaningful to me. So just the other day, I received an email from a patient of mine showing me the picture of her new grandchild and saying, thank you for helping me to get to this part of my life that I could appreciate that. So that kind of, again, reinforces me. Why are we here? Why are we coming into this cancer center every day? It's to allow people to enjoy life and so on. So that is incredibly meaningful to me. And then the other compliment, to use your word, is hearing from former trainees and saying, gee, you know, I ran into this roadblock, but your advice got me through it, or you helped me get to where I am. That also is gratifying. You know, I've been in oncology for a few decades now, but time goes by quickly and everyone's career is finite, but seeing that next generation of people do well, seeing our patients do well, that to me is the most satisfying part of what I do.
Great, great. You're so deeply engrossed in you know, helping people succeed, and then, you know, Emory and Harvard and all of those places, we're lucky to have you. Any particular mentee that kind of, you know, is, I'm sure there will be many over the years, but is there anyone particular who kind of you remember that, oh, this particular student that I chaperoned through their careers?
I've been fortunate to have many wonderful mentees, and the best mentees are the ones kind of who are self-starters, where I feel I'm not really even contributing anything. I'm just kind of encouraging them, and they are driving their career forward. Mm-hmm. But in answer to your question, I think in some ways I get the most satisfaction from mentees who took a longer route, or who had difficulties, or who had been discouraged from pursuing their path, or had difficulties in getting to where they wanted to be, and helping those people and reinforcing that they could succeed and they also can contribute. That I think has been very gratifying. People who are very close to leaving science or leaving medicine, or who had been discouraged, and helping them get back on that path, that in some ways has been the most gratifying thing to me.
I can see that. Absolutely. That's like almost trying to talk them off the ledge.
Yeah. So again, the people, you know, there are people who, again, were the A+ peoples all their lives. And yes, so they're an A+ with me, but I can't take too much credit for that. But the people who are saying, gee, you know, I was told that I should drop out of school, or I should stop my scientific career, or that I'll never be a physician, and helping get those people through that, I'm very happy about.
Absolutely. With your, you know, diverse, like, you know, patient care and research and all of the things that you are involved with around the lab and such, what does, I mean, you're equal parts educator over your career and researcher, but are you a little more of one than the other?
Well, I love everything that I do. You know, people say, oh, gee, you're doing all these different things. I love everything that I do. And it's definitely true that you don't want to spread yourself too thin. But I've taken care of patients since I was handed my medical degree. I've always taken care of patients. I love that. I can never see not doing that. I love running a lab and addressing important scientific questions about cancer pathogenesis and developing therapies and having these bright young people in the lab doing the research and encouraging them. And it is certainly true that after I come back to the lab after a clinic, I am only more inspired to say we have to do better. We have to develop more treatments. So I love taking care of patients. I love the lab. The clinical work inspires the lab research. Not infrequently, I'll have patients who will say, gee, can I come and see your laboratory? And we'll bring them to the lab. And that's very good for the scientists in the lab. They know they're doing cancer research, but when a real human being is in front of them and looking through the microscope of those cells and saying, gee, I hope you're successful in developing new treatments, that is inspiring to them too. So that combination of patient care and research and educating that next generation, to me, they're all parts of that same ecosystem, and I love being part of all of it.
Over the decades of career of, and you know, your hematologic cancers, leukemias, the treatment has changed so much. Like you mentioned, we came from antifolates now to very NGS-based treatments. And there is more on the horizon now that we are getting these newer AI models that are coming in. And for somebody who is, you know, some of the people in the audience who are trying to get into medicine and like, you know, you're hearing that AI is taking up jobs now. How do you see AI or the impact of that in oncology in general, but leukemia and hematology in particular?
Well, I don't think we can avoid AI or say, I don't believe in AI, I'm going to ignore it. I don't think that's going to be possible. But right now and for the foreseeable future, I see AI as our companion, as our helper, as our buddy, not replacing us, just helping us do better. And whether it's in a clinical area, helping identify clinical trials for patients, have it assess a patient's electronic medical record and then pair it up with clinical trials, we've used that type of capability. It's not perfect and it makes mistakes, but it helps. And so that's why I don't feel I'm going to be replaced, but I'm helped. Similarly, in the laboratory, designing molecules to block transcriptional pathways, AI has been helpful in giving us leads, but it is not perfect. And sometimes there are errors. So I would never rely on that solely, but it helps us. So I think for the foreseeable future, AI will be our buddy, our pal. It will not replace us. We should not be afraid of it. And I think it also speaks to partnering with computer scientists and people who have expertise in other areas and sitting down with them and telling them about what problems we're facing. And they tell us about the capabilities they're developing in machine learning and artificial intelligence. And we've had wonderful collaborations that way. So I think it's not something we should fear, but look to partner with.
Absolutely. That's great advice. There is, you know, the most recent chemistry, you know, basically on looking at it, the research side of things, the Nobel Prize went to AlphaFold, where there's this computer AI that is looking at molecules and generating the protein three-dimensional structures. With that, do we see that there is going to be an acceleration in using that AI technology towards leukemia? And do you see a lot more promising treatments out there that are on the horizon for leukemia?
I do. So again, when I started as a leukemia physician, the treatment for acute myeloid leukemia was a combination of cytarabine and an anthracycline like daunorubicin. In some ways, in 2025, that still remains our core therapy. Other things have developed, but that is kind of the core. But I think having things like DNA hypomethylating agents and BCL2 inhibitors and IDH inhibitors, these are just opening up whole new areas of care. But there are complexities. And again, I think computer models can help us understand things. So for example, if there's an activated FLT3 kinase through a mutation, now we have drugs that can bind to the ATP binding pocket of FLT3 and block its kinase activity. we can all understand that there's a mutation in activated kinase and we're targeting that. One interesting area, for example, is the development of inhibitors of the protein menin. And those are useful in leukemias in which there's a translocation of KMT2A or a mutation in NPM1. So mutations in other proteins, but a vulnerability in menin, which might not have been apparent initially. And so I think the more we can integrate knowledge, which AI is very powerful in doing, the more we'll be able to identify these vulnerabilities that may not be as obvious as a FLT3 inhibitor for a mutated FLT3, but more akin to inhibiting menin with a KMT2A translocation.
Something to kind of look forward to in the leukemia space in years to come. Those things and the gene advances, and with these kind of more developments that are happening, do you think, is there any pressure on the basic science side to kind of, is that true to say that there is more pressure to try and deliver more because now they are more able based on the computers and the AI assistance that they get?
Well, that's interesting. So, you know, we talk about the development of treatment for leukemia. When I was a graduate student, if I wanted to look at changes in gene expression, I would do a Northern blot and look at one gene at a time. Now, of course, we use techniques like RNA sequencing, and we look at 20,000 genes, including non-coding RNAs and so on. So the amount of knowledge being generated is orders of magnitude greater, but our ability to then sort through that data and find what are the important aspects of it, that has to keep up. So yes, I think our scientists can generate more data, but interpreting the deluge of data that come out of experiments now, I think, is one of the challenges. But it's a wonderful time now to be a basic or translational scientist. It's a wonderful time to be a computer scientist. And I think the more we meet together in an interdisciplinary way, the more we'll be able to make discoveries that will really impact human beings.
Oh, that's, you know, that's amazing. So, Dr. Frank, you know, when the 7+3 was kind of the standard of care when, you know, and it has been the workhorse even now. But with all these new, you know, breakpoint into what AML constitutes, the FLT3s, the ITAs, the different genotypes and such, it's great that we have more, you know, treatment options. But as a treating hematologist, is that like, does that make the job harder or easier? Like for somebody who is new and coming out of fellowship now, or training into fellowship, they're now having to look at more data. And obviously we want that because it's good for the patients. But how would you advise people to, because keeping up to date on the material has never been harder either. How do you, because you're a stalwart in the field, how do you stay up to date, and what typical sources do you look at, and how what would you advise for the fellows to do?
That is a very astute question. As the knowledge expands, our human brains still have only a finite capacity to integrate everything. And I think using all sources of information, I still get journals in print form, which I read. I obviously spend a lot of time on the computer doing searches, and trying to balance all of that is so important. But again, going to meetings, going to a meeting like ASH or AACR or ASCO and hearing other experts in the field and how they approach things, I think it's that collective knowledge that is so important. So yes, it is essential that we keep up with the care that is cutting edge, because we should not be taking care of patients if we're not giving them the absolute best treatment. I will say the flip side of that is I may have treated over 1,000 patients with leukemia, but for the person sitting there in front of me, this is the first time they've had it. And never being jaded and always focusing on that individual and teaching them about their disease and talking to them about it at the level that they are comfortable at talking about it, that is equally important as knowing what is going on with all 3 billion base pairs in their genome.
So it's you kind of coming full circle. It's patient-centric, and that's what you started with, absolutely. switching gears a bit, you're doing all of the research and education. At the end of the day, what do you do to, what does unwinding look like for you?
Well, that's a very good point. And I spend a lot of time talking to my faculty about wellness. Mm-hmm. Wellness is an important general term, but eating well, exercising well, getting enough sleep, having human interactions are all very important. So I do like spending time with my family. I do like spending time outdoors and exercising and appreciating life and appreciating the beauty of the world. That is very meaningful to me. And that helps recharge me and re-energize me.
Great. I saw that you are famous also for hosting journal clubs at your place for trainees and mentees and such. Is that something you did even at Harvard, or is that something you started there and you continued here? Or?
Well, so I like to combine the interpersonal interactions of medicine with rigorous data-driven evidence-based approaches. So having journal clubs is incredibly important. In hematology, we have a number of different journal clubs. And I like everyone to feel that we're all colleagues and that we all are comfortable with each other. So saying to people, hey, let's all come over to my house and we'll have a little food and something to drink and we'll sit and talk about papers together. I think that's a nice way to bridge the personal and the data-driven parts of medicine. And again, I often say to the faculty that we have, I want you to enjoy coming to work every day. I don't want you to feel, oh, it's kind of a hardship to come. I want you to enjoy the people you're with, what our mission is, and what we do.
Great. Frankly, when you're home and then, you know, you're trying this whole interpersonal and you have mentees and you are kind of tutoring and taking through. For the aspiring students who tune in and trying to get some advice from you, what are certain characteristics or couple that you look for in a mentee that you think is most attributed to them succeeding eventually? And this could be just somebody trying to get into med school, into residency, into fellowship, or even junior faculty trying to get into, you know, make their mark in the field.
Yes. Well, I think being rigorous, trying to understand things at a deep level, being honest, being transparent, being personable, these are all very important characteristics. I often say when people ask to come to my laboratory, we can teach them about transcriptional pathways. We can teach them how to study that. But if somebody is not dedicated, if somebody is not reliable, if somebody is not truthful, then it's kind of hard to overcome that. So I think those basic characteristics have not gone out of style, and they're really important for success in any of these careers.
Great. I think this was great advice. If you had to give some advice, like you said, it's just kind of go back to the basics. Be trustworthy, be honest, and be true to your word, I guess. What do you see on the horizon on how would the field be transformed in years to come, or anything in particular that you are looking forward to in years to come within oncology, hematology, just in general?
I love seeing all of the advances that are coming along. You know, you mentioned things like next generation sequencing, but now spatial analysis, spatial transcriptomics, if you have a pathology slide and being able to tell within that slide where certain genes are upregulated or suppressed, where certain immune cells are present or absent. I think those are phenomenally exciting aspects of medicine. And I think that they will translate into new and better therapies. We're seeing the potential for things like CAR T cells to cure people of diseases that would have been fatal not too long ago. So I think these advances are fantastic, but I don't want to diminish the importance of being able to relate to another human being. Every patient will come in will be different. They'll have different backgrounds, different experiences. And no matter how sophisticated we may be with next generation sequencing, we have to be able to relate to that human being at a level at which they're comfortable, at which they understand what is happening and feel comfortable and confident in moving forward.
Perfect. Any particular goals that you have kind of set for yourself, work or pleasure-wise, in the next few years?
Well, from the work standpoint, again, trying to develop new treatments that go from the lab into clinical trials for patients, that I think is kind of the core of what we're doing on the research side. So that is very enjoyable. The people in my lab, of course, love that as well. They really can see their impact. They love getting the samples back from the patients on the clinical trial, analyzing, are we hitting the target, and then going back to the patient. So continuing to develop better treatments for people with cancer, that inspires me every day. Continuing to train that next generation of talented people, that never loses its enjoyment to me. And then trying to enjoy being in the world with my family, with the people in the community, trying to help people in other ways as well. I think those are the types of goals that I have for myself.
Great, great. Well, I think that kind of concludes us for the life journey for Dr. David Alan Frank. And thank you, Dr. Frank, for your time. It was a genuine pleasure talking with you. I learned a lot, and I'm sure our viewers will as well.
Thank you. It was my pleasure.